But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else no sooner than she got out of high school. And the last time I was in Cleveland, I heard that she's been married 3 times. You will notice that this poem that I just read you is a pre-verse poem. At that time, it was as nearly as I could write a poem in the style of Carl Sandburg. I think you can definitely see his influence in the poem. But you can also see the influence of the Negro spirituals in the little refrain. But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else no sooner than she got out of high school. And the last time I was in Cleveland, I heard that she's been married 3 times. You will notice that this poem that I just read you is a pre-verse poem. At that time, it was as nearly as I could write a poem in the style of Carl Sandburg. I think you can definitely see his influence in the poem. But you can also see the influence of the Negro spirituals in the little refrain. And I wasn't aware of being influenced by folk songs at that time, but later on, I became aware of how often they crept into my poetry, and then I deliberately began to try to write poems in the manner of the spirituals and the blues. So I might read you maybe one or two of those right now. The Negro spirituals, I'm sure you know, are a folk form that has gone out of existence, that is, as far as being newly created goes. The great spirituals like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and Go Down Moses have sort of become American classics, I guess you might say. And spirituals are no longer being made up by the people. But the blues are a living folk form right now today. The blues are not as old as the spirituals. The spirituals go way back to slavery time. The blues are, as nearly as anybody can tell, a kind of folk form that came into bloom really around the early 1900s. And the first blues to be written down on paper, you know, was W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues. And then a few years later, he wrote the very famous St. Louis Blues, which I think is a very interesting song because in traveling all around the world, I used to be in the Merchant Marine, and then later I went around the world as a writer to Asia and all around. And everywhere, almost as I have been, you hear the St. Louis Blues. I heard it in Japan, played on Japanese jukeboxes, sung in Japanese. I heard it in Russia, sung in Russian. And in Central Europe and in Paris, the St. Louis Blues is a very popular song. In fact, many Europeans used to think that the St. Louis Blues was the American national anthem. You know, whenever a tourist would go in a restaurant, they'd immediately begin to play the St. Louis Blues. I don't know if they still do that now or not. But you may remember reading a story in Time at the end of the war when the German occupation troops were withdrawing from Paris and the American troops were coming in and the first American reporters were going into liberated Paris. And they heard over all the loudspeakers on the street corners, you know, the Germans had installed loudspeakers for propaganda purposes. And over these loudspeakers, I heard the St. Louis Blues being played, I suppose as a welcome to the American troops, probably. But the Germans were still within the city limits, and the censorship presumably was still on. And one of the reporters was very curious as to how the French people could get away with playing the St. Louis Blues, because Hitler had banned, as you know, all Negro music and Jewish music, and particularly blues like the St. Louis Blues. So this man went to the radio station and asked about this, and he was told that the French people in Paris had played the St. Louis Blues all during the Nazi occupation. And he asked, well, how could you get away with it? And they said, well, we told the Hitler censorship people that the St. Louis Blues really wasn't an American song at all, that the Americans had simply stolen it from the French. It's really as an old French folk song, and the St. Louis is really about Louis Quatorze. And and the woman with the diamond rings was Marie Antoinette, and so on. Well, anyway, that simply indicates how much they like our American blues music over there, you know? So when I began to try to write poems in the manner of our folk, Negro folk music, first the spirituals and then the blues, I, at that time, seemed to be doing something that no other American poets were trying to do. Since then, quite a few of our poets have written in the idiom of these songs, but 20 years ago, apparently nobody was doing it very much. And so it was my poems in this style that first really attracted any attention to my work. And before I tell you how I got my first literary prize and so on, what really started my professional career, I'll read you a little one called Feet of Jesus, a very short little poem that you might almost call the breath of a spiritual. It goes like this. At the feet of Jesus, sorrow like a sea, Lordy, let your mercy come drifting down on me. At the feet of Jesus, at your feet I stand. Oh, my precious Jesus, please reach out your hand. And now, in the manner of the blues are quite different from the spirituals in form and subject matter. The spirituals have no set form, really. One spiritual may be quite different from another. But the traditional blues are always a long lyric line repeated, and then a third line that rhymes with the first two. And I try to preserve that traditional form in my poems. And then the subject matter of the blues is almost always a very sad subject matter, usually about being broke, a long ways from home, hungry, out of work. Those are the blues that the men sing. The blues, by the way, are individual songs, too. The spirituals are group songs. But the blues are usually sung by one man or one woman alone. And the women usually sing about affairs of the heart, usually about some man who's gone off and left her before she's ready for him to go. I will read you a blues for a man to sing, and you can tell that this blues was written some years ago because it mentions the WPA. It's a depression time blues, but it's sort of typical of the one phase of subject matter in the blues, of being out of work. And this one goes like this. I walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I done walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I've been looking for a job so that I could eat. I couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. Couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. WPA man told me, you got to live here a year and a day. A year and a day, Lord, in this great big lonesome town. A year and a day in this great big lonesome town. I might starve for a year, but that extra day would get me down. Well, that is the mood of the blues, usually despondency, but something somewhere in the lyric that will make people laugh. A poem of mine called The Weary Blues that gave the title to my first book won the Opportunity Prize. Opportunity was the Negro magazine of the Urban League. The prize was $50. I was living in Washington at the time, working as a busboy at the Wardman Park Hotel, when I got word that I had received this poetry award, and they asked me to come to New York to the literary banquet being given to receive my prize. Well, $50, I spent my prize going to get it, because it cost almost that much to go to New York from Washington and get this money. So I didn't really benefit by the money, but the publicity from it. There was an editorial in the Herald Tribune, I believe, and articles in the papers. It really began my career. Editors paid some attention to this award. I got a note from Vanity Fair, which was a magazine sort of like Harper's Bazaar at that time, asking me for poetry. I got another note from the New Republic. And so I began to have my poetry published in real paying magazines. In other words, I got paid for a few poems. Up to that time, I'd just given them away. Well, now, please don't anyone here think you can really make a living from poetry. You can't. Unfortunately, even today, I think most magazines don't pay any more than 50 cents a line. That's one reason poets make their lines as short as they can, you know, so they can have a lot of lines. And most of my poems are really quite short. And so, when I got my first checks for my poems, fortunately, Vanity Fair bought a whole group of them, and paid me $75. Gee, I thought that was an awful lot of money, and I still do. But most of the time, I would get maybe $5 or $6 or $8 for a poem, and that would be all. And that is true right now. So that is one reason why I went into other forms of writing, I guess. I realized that I couldn't really live as a writer from poetry, so I tried to write stories and novels and radio scripts and plays. And from those, I have managed now to live for about 25 years without having had a job. I've looked for jobs, but haven't found them. Occasionally, I've been invited to teach creative writing and have done it for a semester, but haven't really had a regular job in a long time. I have really made a living as a writer, more or less from the time, or from a few years after the time that I received this prize. Well, another very nice thing that happened to me, and that helped me greatly, was that while I was working in the Warden Park Hotel dining room, Vachel Lindsay came into the dining room one day. He was reading his poems in the little theater of the Warden Park Hotel in Washington, which at that time was the leading hotel before the Mayflower was built. Many of the senators and diplomats stayed there. And I very much wanted to hear Vachel Lindsay read his poems. I'd never seen him before. I'd loved his poetry. And here he was going to give them himself in person that night in the little theater of this hotel. But I couldn't go. I couldn't buy a ticket. They wouldn't sell tickets to Negroes to any theater in Washington, as I'm sure you know. Until just in recent years could we go to a public place in the city of Washington outside the Negro district. So I couldn't hear Vachel Lindsay. So I thought, well, I'll give him some of my poems to read anyway. So between lunch and dinner, I wrote some of my poems out, including The Weary Blues that won the prize, and put them down beside his plate at dinner in the dining room. I was very shy in those days, so I didn't say anything to him except that I try to write poetry too and hear some of my poems or something like that, and I went away, and I didn't see him anymore. Well, the next morning when I came to work, there were reporters out there and a cameraman, and they were all waiting for me at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they said, "You've been discovered." And it turned out that Vachel Lindsay had read on his own program all three of the poems that I had given him and had told the people that he thought that I was a poet of talent, and in other words, had given me a wonderful send-off, and it was all in the morning papers, but I hadn't read the papers. And so the reporters interviewed me, and they took a picture of me in the middle of the dining room holding up a big tray of dishes, and I was discovered. Well, a few months thereafter, my first book was published. And so that is the way I became a professional writer and a professional poet. Now, many of my poems deal with the problems of segregation and prejudice in our country, and so I might just as well read you one or two of them now, since I've just been talking about one phase of that problem. Also, at the time that I was working as a busboy and trying to save enough money to go to college, jobs like running elevators and shining shoes and being a porter were almost the only kinds of jobs that young Negroes could get. Fortunately, things have changed greatly in our country, particularly since the last war. And it's no longer true that in most of the larger communities, Negroes need be limited to menial jobs, but it was true at that time. Now, in big cities like New York and Chicago and Detroit, as I'm sure you all know, you see Negro clerks in the downtown shops. In New York, you see Negro girls as cashiers sometimes in Macy's or Bloomingdale's or Lord and Taylor's, and all that has changed. Formerly, a Negro girl couldn't even be a switchboard operator for the telephone company. But in many cities now, Negro girls can. Well, anyway, some of my very early poems were particularly about the problem of color and work. And I'll read you one that you probably have all seen or studied sometime or other, because it's in the Untermeyer anthology, among others, that's used in many of the English courses. One called Brass Spittoons. It goes like this. "Clean the spittoons, boy. Detroit, Chicago, Atlantic City, Palm Beach, clean the spittoons. The steam in hotel kitchens, and the smoke in hotel lobbies, and the slime in hotel spittoons. Part of my life. Hey, boy. A nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2 a day. Hey, boy. A nickel, a dime, a dollar, $2. Buy shoes for the baby. House rent to pay. Parties on Saturday. Church on Sunday. My God. Babies and parties and church and women and Sunday, all mixed up with dimes and dollars and clean spittoons and house rent to pay. Hey, boy. A bright bowl of brass is beautiful to the Lord. Bright, polished brass, like the cymbals of King David's dancers, like the wine cups of Solomon. Hey, boy, a clean spittoon on the altar of the Lord, a clean, bright spittoon, all newly polished. At least I can offer that. Come here, boy. I think you can again see the Sandburg influence on that early poem of mine.